I'm Bill Barole. Over the last few decades, I've done every kind of writing there is to do, from journalism to humor, books, movies, and television.
I'm Matt Ricardo. For the last 30 years, I've toured the world as a variety performer.
We've come together across the Atlantic to talk about creativity, what it is, where it comes from, why it matters.
Thomas Edison said, "To invent, you need a good imagination and a pile of junk."
This is Imagination and Junk, a conversation about the hard work of creativity.
Episode 15, Mousetrap.
Hi, it's Bill.
And Matt.
We're doing something different with this episode, which is the last one of season two.
Right. We're each of us going to tell a story about the worst day of our lives as creative people.
Yes. We're going to voluntarily relive those days, which were, let me be clear, absolutely awful. Why? For your amusement.
And also, maybe, we're going to come to some conclusions about what, if anything, we took away from those experiences.
But that's for after.
For now, here's Bill with a story about the worst meeting in the history of show business. Please enjoy his pain.
This story is adapted from a piece I wrote in 2012 for the website Boing Boing. Okay, so in the late 90s, I was working as a sitcom writer. And in the spring of 1998, I was between jobs. My agent lined up a meeting for me with Al Franken, who was then a few years removed from Saturday Night Live and running a show called Late Line, a behind-the-scenes comedy about a TV news program. Franken wanted to meet me, my agent told me, because I had a news background, having been a writer for Newsweek before I moved to Los Angeles. My recollection is that Late Line was produced out of New York. Franken would fly out to Los Angeles to hold a few days' meetings with prospective hires at a hotel in West Hollywood. And so the meeting got set for breakfast a week or so later. I arrived a little early that day and found Franken in the hotel restaurant where he was meeting with another writer. He asked me if I'd mind waiting for a few minutes, so I took a seat in the lobby. One historical note, although this story does not predate cell phones, it does predate, apparently, Al Franken having a cell phone, so keep that in mind. After a few moments, the telephone rang at the maitre d' station, which sat in the lobby a few feet outside the dining room entrance, about 20 feet away from where I was sitting. The maitre d' answered the call, listened for a moment, and then went inside and came back with Franken. The writer with whom Franken had just met, their meeting now concluded, continued through the lobby and left. Franken picked up the phone, and here's what I heard him say.
"Hi, honey. No, still having meetings.
What?
CNN?
No, why?" He listened for a long moment, and then I saw all the color drain from his face. And I heard him say,
He's dead? He's dead? Phil's dead? What happened? He was murdered? Shot? What about Bryn? Is she... Bryn shot him? Bryn shot Phil and she's dead? They're both dead?"
This went on for a few more minutes. And at some point, I don't remember exactly how, there may have been a radio on somewhere. I learned that morning, out in Encino, Franken's friend and colleague, Phil Hartman, had been shot and killed by his wife, Bryn, who then killed herself. Franken eventually hung up the phone and stood there, silent and distraught. Okay. You have to understand my line of thinking at that moment. The guy was obviously shaken, and who wouldn't be? The last thing I wanted to do just then was force him to sit down and hold a business meeting. In the spirit of full disclosure, let me add that I also didn't like my chances of holding his focus while I pitched myself for a job over orange juice and croissants. It felt weird and wrong, and like it wasn't going to end well for anybody. I figured the best thing I could do was extend my condolences and offer to reschedule the meeting, which I did. "No," Franken said distractedly.
"I'm only out here for the day. I have to go back tonight. We have to have this meeting now."
"Al," I said, in what was surely the biggest understatement of my show business career, "I'm not sure that's a good idea." But Franken was insistent. We'd meet now, and he had a request. Would I mind, he asked, if we had the meeting in his room upstairs, so he could keep one eye on CNN. Now, Matt, I know you know this, but for the benefit of listeners who may not, let me give you a little background. A show business meeting is a performance. If you're in the position I was in that morning, you're the performer, and the person across the table is the audience. And you want them to be captivated by what you're selling, which is always some aspect of yourself, your talent, your humor, your intelligence. All of this requires their attention. Up to that moment, I'd been pretty successful at capturing the attention of the people with whom I'd met for various jobs. Not universally so. One famous showrunner sat there and went through his mail while I recapped my resume. No, I won't tell you who it was. Yeah, I will. It was Chuck Lorre. This meeting seemed fairly certain to be worse than that meeting. But what was I going to do? So up to Franken's room we went, and as promised, he switched on the TV and tuned it to CNN. Well, I have to say, it wasn't my best meeting ever. I talked, he listened, sort of. I kept glancing up to see him focusing one eye on the TV behind me. Occasionally, I'd hear a word or two break through. 911 call. Murdered. Shot. Coroner. Suicide. I managed to limp through a presentation of my qualifications for the job, and then I finished, and then I stopped. And then, here's the thing. It got worse. It did. It got worse. I guess CNN must have finally run through what little hard information it had on the Hartman murder-suicide and started vamping, because Franken switched off the set and at last focused fully on me. All right, he said. I wanted to meet you because I like your work and because you have a news background that would work well for my show. I remember thinking, okay, so far so good. Now, I did a little checking on you, he continued. I asked my friend Howard Feynman about you. Okay, I thought again. Not an unreasonable thing for Franken to have done. Feynman was then, and had been during my tenure at Newsweek, a big wheel in the Washington bureau of the magazine. Franken said, he told me two things about you. The first one was, you totally changed what it was possible to do in the back of the book at Newsweek. He said you're a real trailblazer in terms of writing with a casual voice and some attitude. I thought this was very nice of Feynman, if a little hyperbolic, and I said so. Then I asked Franken, what was the second thing? Franken said calmly, that you're a screamer. Excuse me? I said, blinking rapidly a couple hundred times. Franken said, you yell at people. You go nuts when you don't get your way, and you scream at people and treat them badly and make their lives miserable. I wish I could tell you I have a clear recollection of what I said next, but the truth is all I remember is a loud roaring in my ears. I think I eventually managed to sputter something to the effect that, one, Feynman worked in D.C. and I worked in New York, that we never crossed paths and neither did our co-workers. Two, I had never even met Feynman face to face. I still haven't, by the way, all these years later. And three, what he was saying was, not for nothing, totally and demonstrably untrue. But I think I also had the glimmer of a sense right away in that moment that I was a dead man walking. There was no way in hell I was going to get this job. I think I may have also had the presence of mind to wonder why Franken had decided to meet with me at all under the circumstances. I still don't know. But I do have a theory. You may remember a character Franken created for Saturday Night Live and later spun off into a book and a movie, Stuart Smalley, who was so addicted to 1970s-style self-actualization that it controlled his life.
And I'm going to help people. Because I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
Franken has said Smalley was born out of his exposure to Al-Anon, a support group for the friends and family members of alcoholics. Here's the disclaimer. I don't know to what degree Franken himself was or is personally a fan of Smalley-style self-improvement dogma. But I've always wondered if, in some part, he wanted to meet with me because he saw an opportunity to intervene in the life of someone he believed to be struggling with destructive personal behaviors. It was a beautiful tiger trap in a way. However much I might have protested or tried to correct the record, that only would have hardened his position because it wouldn't mean he was wrong, it would mean I was in denial. Now, none of this occurred to me that morning, but the theory started to gel over the following days. A week or so later, when my agent called to tell me I hadn't gotten the job, no kidding, I remember thinking, I called Franken to thank him for the meeting and wish him the best with the show. I left a message, and he called me back a day or so later.
Well, he said, you seem like you're basically a nice guy. My hope for you is that you get some help with your problems. Well, it's 25 years later, and I never worked another day in television. That's not Franken's fault. My career was already going in another direction. About a year ago, I told this story to a friend of mine who'd been at Newsweek when I was, and we managed to figure out, we think, who it was Feynman had actually been describing. A guy who had been at the magazine when we were, worked in more or less my part of the magazine, even bore a superficial resemblance to me. It doesn't matter. Do I wish Feynman had been a little more solid in his facts? Sure, wouldn't have been a bad thing for a reporter to be. But ultimately, it doesn't matter. Here's the part that matters. I wasn't always so sanguine about this story. It stuck in my craw for about a dozen years, until the night I saw Franken, then in his first term, stand up on the floor of the U.S. Senate to eulogize his old comedy partner, Tom Davis. You can still see the clip of the speech online. Now, you have to remember that in his first term, Franken barely even mentioned his time in comedy. He kept his head down and worked, understanding, I think, that he had to overcome people's expectations that he was a show pony, a dilettante, just a comedian. I think this night may have been the first time as a senator he ever even referred to his comedy career. It was certainly the first time he ever spoke about it at any length. Standing on the floor of what was, at the time, widely considered to be the greatest deliberative body in the world, Franken took the time to speak feelingly of a guy with whom he'd been young, had a falling out, reconciled, grown older. He was loving and forgiving, and generous, not only toward Davis, but to a couple of generations of his peers, many of them now gone. He was even expansive on the subject of comedy itself, remembering late nights in SNL's 17th floor offices at 30 Rockefeller Plaza.
Woody Allen once said that writing comedy is either easy or it's impossible. When it's impossible, it can be agony, let me tell you. When it's easy, when you're laughing, when you're rolling on the floor, literally, when Danny or Billy or Belushi or Gilda or Dana Carvey or Jim Downey or Conan O'Brien or Steve Martin or any of the many just hilarious people that we had the privilege to work with would come up with something that just made you explode with laughter and roll on the floor there on the 17th floor, that was just pure joy.
This is the kind of ex post facto reflection you don't tend to get from younger guys, mostly because they're still, you know, facto, and they lack perspective, which is, you kids, trust me when I tell you this, more and more hard won. The speech bristled with feeling, and it's studded with great little nuggets, like this one, about the Franken and Davis sketch in which Julia Child, played by Dan Aykroyd, cuts herself while slicing liver and begins, spectacularly, to bleed to death.
It was a tour de force by Danny, and when I was with Danny and Tom a couple weeks ago, we started talking about this somehow, and Danny said that he remembers me there under the counter pumping the blood. Only I wasn't the one pumping the blood, it was Tom. And I remember that that was something of a union issue, because that's a special effect, pumping blood.
Watching Franken in middle age, letting go of the old hurts and slights, to eulogize the friend and partner of his youth, I couldn't help thinking about that day in West Hollywood. And all I could think was, you know what? It's okay, Al. Forget it. He was misinformed, but if I had to assign a motive to his actions, I'm going to assume he did what he did out of good intentions, because life's too short. And the fact is, I'd like somebody to eulogize me like Franken did Davis. Although, you know, not anytime soon. It's okay, Al. Godspeed. Oh, and Howard, if you're hearing this, give me a call. Let me talk to you for a second. It's kind of a funny story. And now, here's Matt with a story about a gig that went so sideways, it almost created an international incident.
One of the things I love about my job is the randomness of it all. I can do what I do pretty much anywhere and to anyone, which means that every so often I'll get an email from a stranger, which will be the start of a fun adventure in a far-flung location. And that's how this started, with an email. And yes, it led to an adventure in a far-flung location, but it wasn't fun. It was bad. Flee the country, bad. So I got an email. It was from the official Chinese Guinness Book of Records TV show. They asked me if there was a record that I'd like to come on their show and break. And there was. The finale of my cabaret act is a variation on the old tablecloth pull trick. So I thought it would be fun to pull the biggest tablecloth ever pulled. Fun, right? Good TV. So I told my agent that I wanted to go to China and do this show. And my agent said, great idea. Okay, my agent didn't say that. My agent voiced concern and caution, but I ignored him because I was going to get to pull a huge tablecloth on television. Anyway, we signed contracts and started making arrangements for them to fly me over. We also started making sure that they knew exactly what props I'd need for the trick. The props are key. The right size long table, the exact right kinds of vases of flowers, crockery, trays, glasses. And then, the day arrived and off to Beijing I went. There was a driver waiting at the airport and I got taken to my hotel, where I met some of the other people who'd be on the show. All people who can do one very specific thing better than anyone else, which is strange and beautiful in its own way. I got given my vegetarian meal, which consisted of some lettuce floating in a bowl of warm water. I made my excuses, went up to my room for a protein bar and my bed. Jet-lagged, but excited to be embarking on another silly adventure. The next day, I meet the production staff, and I get told that even though we had weeks and weeks of emails about the props that I'd need, they haven't got anything. So they take me out to a market to find the right stuff, which, because we're now tight for time, we can't really get, so we end up with stuff that's kind of okay, but not really. It doesn't inspire confidence, but maybe I think to myself, this is just how things are done here. And then I get to the studio. It's one of those huge hangar-type studios, big enough to drive cars around in and still hold an audience of several hundred people, which is what will be there in a few days' time when I do my thing. I get introduced to the director and producers who welcome me and then start to tell me about the record that they'd like me to break. And it's not what we agreed. Not at all. It involves tablecloths vaguely, but it's completely different, and as they're describing it, it seems totally made up and not, in fact, actually possible. So I say, no, I'm here to pull the longest tablecloth, that's what we agreed. And they all talk amongst themselves for a while, and then finally switch back to English and tell me, okay, we'll do that as well. I say. Okay, I guess. And that's when the unsettling feeling started to set in that something was off. The next day, I meet the Guinness Book of Records officials, who wear their branded blazers even when the cameras are not rolling. I talk to them about the ins and outs of pulling the longest tablecloth, and they seem puzzled, which is something that I, at the time, completely failed to pick up on. I spend the next couple of days hanging around backstage with some of the other performers, and the more I learn, the more things start to feel hinky. There's an acrobat who specialises in a very specific piece of equipment. He's the current world record holder in it, but he wants to break his own record on TV. Except, they made the equipment to different specifications, so when he rehearses, he injures himself. But, just by chance, they've got a Chinese performer who's been training with their version of the equipment, so he can do it just fine. There's a circus performer who walks on ballet point shoes on the necks of champagne bottles. Beautiful thing. But they got her beer bottles, so she can't do it. But the Chinese performer they have waiting in the wings, who's been training with beer bottles, can. The more I chat to the other performers, the more the whole thing starts to feel like a bit of a bait and switch. I start to remember that in some of my emails with them, they mentioned the idea of having someone else compete with me on the show. I shot it down, but now it seemed as suspicious as hell. Was this whole thing actually about inviting Western experts onto a show so they could be beaten on TV by Chinese performers? No, can't be. I'm being paranoid. The next morning, I'm woken by a phone call telling me that despite having done no more rehearsals or meetings, I'm performing on the show in front of a live audience that night. I'm still not even sure what I'm doing, but okay then. I put on my suit and my game face. I get a car to the studio with another performer. He's done a few of these shows, and he tells me that, yeah, they usually spring a surprise competitor on you and cheat it so that you lose, but everyone goes along with it because TV. And I get butterflies in my guts, and I start to feel like I'm a long way from home. Once I'm at the studio, we do the camera rehearsal. Camera rehearsals are there so that the camera operators can plan out the exact shots they'll use. So if it's not in the camera rehearsal, then it's not in the show. And my rehearsal includes the trick that they want me to do, but not the trick that I travelled 5,000 miles to do. I ask about it and get ignored. I end up furious and terrified, now certain that they plan to humiliate me on camera. I ask to speak to the producer. It's important, I say. Sure, they say. Soon. Wait in your dressing room. So I wait. Hours go by. I ask again. Soon. More hours. Soon. Finally, literally 15 minutes before the show is due to start, I get granted an audience with the producer. As I walk to her office, I can already hear the crowd downstairs in the studio. I voice my concerns that we're not doing what we agreed to do, that they're clearly setting me up to fail. The room is full of producers, co-producers, executives, and they all start yelling at me, standing over me as I sit and shouting into my face. If I don't do the show, I get told, they won't pay me. They'll kick me out of my hotel room, they'll cancel my plane ticket, and my visa, maybe it won't work so good now. As the chaos continues, I take out my phone and I call my agent. I tell him what's going on and I hold up the phone so that he can hear what the room sounds like. And my agent says, get out. Now. Airport. So, I calmly stand up and walk out. The producer clearly thinks I've capitulated, that I'm going to get ready to do the show. They have deeply underestimated my ability to be a dick when sufficiently inspired. So, I don't go and get ready. I go and I hug the other performers goodbye, I get my stuff, and for the first time ever, I walk out on a gig. Into the middle of nowhere, on the outskirts of Beijing, at night, in the snow. And I think to myself, well, this'll be a funny story to tell, if I ever make it home. I can see the neon light of a hotel across the road, so I go into reception and ask if they can get me a taxi. Oh no, they say, taxis don't come out this far. That's a bad sign. I think on my feet, and I go back to the studio. I sneak in and I find the lowliest, youngest staff member I can find and I bribe him $50 to drive me to my hotel right now. He says, sure. I'd be shocked if he didn't get fired for that. Sorry, dude. I get my stuff from the hotel and I grab a taxi to the airport. I figure that it takes about 3 hours to film the show. So, if the visa threat was serious, then they'll probably be too busy to follow through with it and cause me problems at the airport until later tonight. So, I have about 3 hours to get on a plane, or I might be getting into a cell instead. Now, what I didn't know at the time is that while I was in a taxi racing to the airport, my agent was having trouble getting me on that plane. Turns out buying a one-way air ticket out of Beijing at very short notice raises all kinds of red flags. But literally, as I walk into the airport, my phone pings and I get a text telling me the flight I'm booked on. I hold my breath as I go through border control, and then I'm homeward bound. And it's such a shame. The Guinness Book of Records was a childhood treasure. I got one most Christmases, although sometimes money was tight, so I'd get last year's. It was a gateway into a world of crazy, amazing people and things, and I'd hoped to join that gang. I don't blame Guinness for what happened. The heel in all of this was a TV company with a dumb agenda that made everything much less fun, especially for me. It is a pity, though, and I still think about pulling the longest tablecloth one day.
Well, that was gut-wrenching. Although, I have to admit, I do get a kick out of picturing you wheeling your big giant road case down some godforsaken Chinese highway in the snow, dressed in your beautiful stage wardrobe. I guess the obvious question to start with is, bad as those stories are, it's fair to say we each of us take some relish in telling them. And that's weird, right? Why is that?
The classic reason to revisit bad experiences is so you don't make the same mistakes again. I've made all the same mistakes again. I don't learn from my bad experiences at all.
Yeah, I'm not sure I buy that in this case. To my mind, one of the things that makes a bad experience the worst experience is that it's one of a kind. So I'm not sure how much of a learning experience it can be. I mean, in my case, it was blundering into a business meeting where I was told I'm psychologically broken by a man who'd known me for 11 minutes. That's a pretty unique situation. At least you have to hope that it is.
What both of our worst experiences have in common is that we found ourselves in a bad place, physically. Both of us stumbling into a place and realizing, oh shit, this is going to go badly, and me being here is making it worse and hurting.
Well, yours was a physical place. Mine was more of a psychological no man's land.
That's true, whereas mine was a giant mousetrap waiting for me. And from fairly early on there were some warning signs. The evasion of the production staff, the confusion of the Guinness judges. But the pull of doing something that I'd never done before was enough to make me dismiss them. It was a mousetrap, but that cheese looked so tasty it's all I could see.
Well, hindsight's a powerful thing. And it's powerfully human. I expect we all tend to look back and see the stuff we missed. And there's a flip side to that too, which is that once we stumble into a dumpster fire, we sometimes figure we can kind of balance the books at some point in the future.
My second worst gig was a long time ago in South Korea, and I jumped at the chance to do another gig in the same place because I wanted to win it back. That's kind of how I always see it. I've done pretty well except for this. This was shit, so I need to go back there and win it back. Which is a weird, stupid thing. That's the American military in the 70s and 80s. We've been to this country, we screwed up, let's go back and try and do it right this time.
Let me ask you about another aspect of this. I remember a point in the middle of my hell day with Al Franken, where it went straight beyond bad and right to funny. I know that sounds weird because we're talking about events that were murder adjacent, but I'd be lying if I denied that. I guess it's a psychological defense mechanism. You kind of turn your tragedy into comedy so your head doesn't explode.
Absolutely.
I mean, if I tried to handle this situation with anything other than a sense of detachment, a sense that I'd left my body and I was watching this horrendous series of misadventures happen to somebody else, I just wouldn't have been able to handle it at all. Did you reach that point as yours was happening to you?
I reached that point immediately. What's interesting is the further away I get from the event in time, the scarier it feels, like walking out on a job in a very far-flung place with no plan whatsoever is a very stupid, risky thing to do. But while it was happening, I was thinking, well, this will be a great story to tell. Immediately, I started writing it all down because, well, that's what people like us do, right? We like telling people stories. I immediately thought, okay, this is going to be the mother of all anecdotes. And it was only as the last bit of it was playing out that I thought, this is only going to make a great anecdote if I actually make it out of here. When I look back on it now, I think I really could have been absolutely screwed.
What was interesting for me was I had that experience of detachment where I was sitting there pitching myself for a job while Franken had one eye on CNN, and words were sort of breaking through like murder and death and blood-soaked. And then Franken would periodically turn to me and say, uh-huh, and tell me about the job you had after that. I still really wanted the job. At no point did I get so detached from the immediate experience that I didn't continue to try to sell myself. I mean, I hadn't left my body that much. I was still in it because I had to get through that meeting. Also, I'd driven across town and valet parked my car, so, you know, I was in for $6 at that point.
We were both just trying to do our jobs, right? Trying to do what we do. Does everyone do that, or just professionally creative people, where when something weird happens, you think, oh, what a great story. Brilliant. Remember these details, because this is hilarious and awful.
I don't know. And with people like us, I also don't know if it's purely a survival mechanism, or if it's also, to some degree, a professional instinct, because everything is material.
It's partly that, but it's definitely a good coping mechanism, seeing your actual life as it happens through the lens of a creative work. It's a really strong coping mechanism.
I agree, but, you know, it's also completely nuts. So Matt, once you were home and safe, what was the useful takeaway for you?
Oh, I don't think I learned anything. I have a healthy distrust for television anyway. I mean, this wasn't the first time I'd ever been fucked over by TV, but it was by far the biggest, but not the first. I guess, if anything, it reinforced my pathological need to be in control. As a performer, when you're on TV, you're the least in control. On stage, you're in charge. On TV, you're a tiny cog in a huge machine.
Here's mine. It wasn't anything I organically learned on my own. I can't claim that this experience triggered any great personal growth on my part. As always, the growth came in the form of a lesson about how to be a better person from my wife, who objectively is a better person than I am. I talked in the story about making that awkward phone call to Franken after I inevitably didn't get the job. It won't surprise you to hear that that wasn't my idea. The way it happened was, I told Jennifer I didn't get the job, and she said, okay, now you got to make the phone call. And I said, sincerely, what phone call? I didn't even know what she was talking about. She said, being an adult, the one where you call Franken and thank him for considering you and wish him the best with the show. And I said, but I don't wish him the best with the show. I now want the show to fail. She said, yeah, I know, but you got to do it anyway. And I said, why? And she said, because it's what you do. I said, no, it's what you do. What I do is write him a blistering email that I regret as soon as I send it. And she said, right, okay, so don't do that. Instead, do this other thing. So I got Franken's number from my agent, and I called him up, and I got his voicemail. And I said, Al, I'm disappointed I didn't get the job, but I want to thank you for meeting with me, and I wish you all the best with the show. And I hung up. And I felt nothing. I felt nothing. I didn't feel virtuous. I didn't feel like I'd made the right call. I felt nothing. But here's what I know in retrospect. If I'd followed my terrible initial instinct, I certainly would have felt worse.
I never sent an email to the people I walked out on, and they never got in contact with me. I guess they kind of thought, well, he called our bluff, let's all just move on. And I'm showing how well I've managed to move on by retelling the story every chance I get. I'm fine, no hard feelings. Some hard feelings. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed this final episode, Cluster Fun Fest.
We'll be back with Season 3 of Imagination and Junk soon.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you then.
Imagination and Junk is written by Bill Barol in the U.S. and Matt Ricardo in the U.K., with audio production by Bill Barol. For more information, show notes, and bonus content, it's imaginationandjunk.com.